The global economy in three American acts. Act one, tariffs. Act two, emerging markets. Act three, interest rates. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Thursday today, the 30th of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with three markers of the global economy, each revealing varying levels of American influence in that global economy. Marker number one was a report from Bloomberg this morning that President Trump has told aides he wants to move ahead with tariffs on another $200 billion worth of Chinese imports, perhaps as early as next week. The equity markets didn't like that. Bond traders didn't like that. Nobody liked it. Market number two comes to us from some of the emerging market economies around the world. The Turkish lira lost more ground against the dollar today, and the Argentine peso tumbled to record lows against the greenback as that country's central bank raised its key interest rate to 60%. A lot of that, yes, has to do with domestic problems in both of those economies, but a lot of it is also because of things happening here. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
Water flows downhill. Money flows to where investors think they can make more of it. And right now, more and more of that money is sloshing its way to the U.S.
We've come out of our crisis, and we've now had a stronger growth period.
Stephen Kaplan teaches international affairs at George Washington University. As the U.S. economy's been doing pretty great, the Fed has raised interest rates, which is basically like waving a big old flag that says, hey, world. Park your money here.
So if investors end up preferring higher yielding U.S. treasuries.
Investors basically ask themselves, why, when the U.S. is looking better and better, am I putting my money in risky places like Argentina or Turkey?
So these countries have to entice investors somehow.
They do that by raising their own interest rates. If they don't, then investors leave. And when investors leave, a country's currency falls.
As your currency starts to fall, your debt becomes more expensive.
Now, that can lead to inflation and even more debt and throw fragile economies into crisis. But does the Fed care?
Well, it actually doesn't matter if they care. What matters is what they actually have the authority to do.
Ann Owen is a professor at Hamilton College.
And what they have the authority to do is manage the U.S. economy.
Policymakers care about other countries if what happens in them affects the U.S.
People in other countries, when their economies experience a downturn, would buy fewer U.S. exports.
But it would take a lot of crises for that to make a major impact right now. And the Fed has said rates are going to keep gradually rising, which means developing countries are going to be struggling for a while. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Marker number three follows directly from what Sabri was just saying about the Fed and interest rates and what the short to medium term future of those rates is going to be. What the Fed does with interest rates, as regular listeners to this program know, is closely tied to inflation in this economy. And we learned this morning that at long, long last, the Fed's preferred measure of inflation, something called personal consumption expenditures, finally hit the Fed's magic number of 2%. So, now, much like the dog that catches the car, what are they going to do about it and what's it going to mean for us? From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong has that one.
Where have you been? Like parents waiting up late for a teenager on Saturday night, economists have long been expecting inflation to arrive at 2%. Mickey Levy at Berenberg Capital Markets says the economy is roaring, people are spending. It's high time businesses raise prices.
With strong spending, not just by consumers, but by businesses and capital spending, and the tight labor markets, this is the type of environment where we can expect inflation to go up moderately further.
He says it's now very likely that the Federal Reserve will do what it's been telegraphing to the world, keep nudging up interest rates to keep inflation in check. Now, everyone's favorite metaphor for this is tapping the brakes. But Nancy Vandenhouten at Oxford Economics says it's more the Fed easing off the gas pedal.
What they're doing at this stage is just continuing to remove some of the significant accommodation and stimulus that was required during the Great Recession and the slow recovery that followed that.
For those of us who borrow, rates should go up for loans connected to short-term interest rates. Car loans, credit cards, adjustable mortgages, says Lachman Acheson at the Economic Cycle Research Institute.
The Fed is suggesting, yes, we're going to raise rates two times this year and X times next year, and they project it out. And so that gets represented in those short-term interest rates.
And he figures prices will keep inching up too, given strong demand for goods and services by consumers and businesses. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Traders didn't much care for that Bloomberg report on tariffs I told you about. We'll see how they feel when they get to work tomorrow about an on-the-record interview with the president that Bloomberg did today, in which he says he is going to pull the United States out of the World Trade Organization if, and this is a quote, they don't shape up. Details, numbers, you know how it goes. The civil war in Syria is now 7 years old. That means some not small number of the millions of people who've crossed the border into Turkey were just getting started in their adult lives, finishing high school maybe or a couple of years into college, when they had to start over from basically nothing. Marketplace's Rima Kreis was in Turkey earlier this summer, where she met some of those young Syrians who were rethinking what their lives are going to be.
Almost every romantic comedy ends with some version of the race against time, like when one person tears through a crowded airport, desperately trying to catch the other one before it's too late.
I love that scene. It's so romantic. And I was watching that movie the other day, and I was like, what if that dude was Syrian? Like, 60% of the movie would be in the visa office, right? Just running from office to office in slow motion, just...
That's Othman Nahas, a Syrian refugee and stand-up comedian. After his show in Istanbul, he tells me that joke always gets laughs.
Not being able to travel is horrifying. So I like to make jokes about it to belittle its power over me, basically.
Nahas is 23, thin, with a small build, and he has a thing for jigsaw puzzles.
As you can tell from my jigsaw puzzle earring, my jigsaw puzzle tattoo, and the jigsaw puzzles that are hanging on my walls.
He says he likes puzzles because all the pieces fit together. You know what you're going to get, which is not how he would describe his life. He was 17 when the conflict in Syria broke out.
I was about to go to college, in theory, yes. I had finished high school.
His parents sent him to Belgium to study, and they fled to Turkey. But his father, a doctor, couldn't find work. So Nahas dropped out of school to teach English in Istanbul and help pay the rent. And he watched a lot of comedy. Seinfeld, Dave Chappelle.
And I always wondered, I was like, oh my God, their life must be so awesome.
He started going to comedy clubs, and one night he took the mic himself.
And I was like, I think I found the thing that most people look for. I think I found why I'm here. I would give up anything for stand-up, literally anything. I mean anything.
He gave up college, and he's fine with it. Unlike hundreds of thousands of other young Syrians who had no choice. In Syria, 25% of young people from urban and rural areas went to universities, which are heavily subsidized by the government. But now many need to work, or they just can't navigate the Turkish education system. Take 27-year-old Mejd. We're not using his last name because he left Syria to avoid the draft and is worried for his family. I met him on a busy street. He was wearing a crisp white button-down, shiny brown shoes, and he was carrying a leather portfolio. I asked him, in Arabic, what's inside. It's his bachelor's degree in economics from Damascus University. Mejd has been in Istanbul for only a week, and already he's having to rethink his future.
I came here to finish my master's program in economics. I thought I'd find more opportunities here, but I didn't realize just how difficult it'd be.
Turkish universities won't accept his degree without paperwork directly from his old school, and his credits may not transfer. Plus, he has to learn Turkish. Yasmin Bekjaji went through all of that. She's among just 20,000 Syrians studying in Turkey.
I'm 26 now. I should be graduated when I was like 23. In my university, it's like 100% Turkish.
Are you for real?
That's why I'm still not graduated.
That's Nahas, the comedian, chiming in. He's friends with Bekjaji. They're hanging out at a hookah bar. Bekjaji had almost finished college in Aleppo when she was arrested for protesting against the Syrian government. Her parents sent her to Turkey to keep her safe and finish her degree in environmental engineering.
I'll save the world.
Sure you will. So our grandchildren can see polar bears? Is that what it is?
Bekjaji says she would like to get started saving the world if she could just finish school.
Sometimes if you think a lot about it, you would just get depressed and stuff. So I don't like to think much about it.
She has one more semester. That's if her Turkish credits transfer to Canada. Her family's immigrating to Montreal soon. Nahas teases her for being privileged. She teases him back.
Dude, I pay for my family's rent.
Oh, really? Oh,
yo, yes, really.
Sorry.
Even so, his mom is not thrilled with his career choice.
She says, oh, you're throwing your life away. Nothing is going to come from this. Why are you doing this? What are you going to do when you're old?
Nahas says it used to bother him, but now he just tries to find the humor in it. In Istanbul, Turkey, I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
Rima's reporting was made possible for us by the International Center for Journalists' Bringing Home the World Fellowship. Corporate story of the day comes to us from Redmond, Washington, the desk of Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella. The company said today it's going to require all of its partners and suppliers and contractors that have more than 50 employees to offer those employees paid parental leave, even though it may ultimately result in increased costs for Microsoft. So, what is Microsoft thinking it's going to be getting for its money? From WESA Marketplace's Eric Barris has that one.
We're in a tight labor market, and this relatively generous policy gives Microsoft an advantage in luring workers, says Beth Humbert, professor at the University of Massachusetts Lowell.
It could be a game changer. It could be a reason for people that particularly care about companies walking the walk to be more attracted to them.
And it makes Microsoft, by requiring its suppliers and third-party vendors to offer a minimum of 12 weeks of paid parental leave, look like a leader, says John Doggett. He's a business professor at the University of Texas at Austin. That's a departure from how tech companies used to operate.
Firms actually discriminated against men and women who wanted to have families because, well, if you have a family and you have those family responsibilities, you can't spend all your time working on the software or the hardware that the company's creating.
A policy like this could set a precedent. When Walmart embraced sustainability, other companies felt pressure to go green. Google started offering catered meals. Now, that's the norm in the tech sector. 3 years ago, when Microsoft required its vendors provide sick leave or vacation time to workers assigned to Microsoft, Facebook did the same. Microsoft works with about 1,000 companies around the country. But economist Abby McCloskey says this move on parental leave speaks to a business model that touches the lives of many thousands more workers at corporations where
you don't have access to the same benefits that you would as an employee.
Microsoft plans to build the cost of extending the leave benefit into its operating expenses. In return, their partners may have an edge in attracting and retaining workers. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Coming up,
hot pink Hummer limousines, bachelorettes with giant balloons, Jägermeister vomit.
I mean, sounds like fun. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 137 today, 0.5%, 25,986. The NASDAQ down 21, 0.25%, 8,088. S&P 500 slumped 12 points, 0.4%, 29,01 there. Talked about inflation finally arriving at 2% as the Federal Reserve considers its interest rate options. So we turn to banks, the banks that watch those interest rates closely. Of course, JPMorgan Chase and Bank of America trickled down 0.4%. Citigroup withdrew 1.4%. Today looked into Microsoft, as we were telling you about. Shares today essentially unchanged. Apple clicked up 0.9%. Oracle slumped 1%. Discount retailer Dollar Tree marked down more than 15% today after its quarterly earnings fell short of analyst projections. Campbell Soup is ladling off its international and fresh business to focus on soups and snacks. Ladling off, get it? Shareholders swallowed a loss of more than 2%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Arthur Brooks, as he will tell you himself, was an unlikely choice to run the center-right American Enterprise Institute. Once a professional musician, French horn, if you're curious, then an academic, Brooks took over one of the biggies of the think tank world 10 years ago, and he announced this past spring he's going to step down next summer. We learned this morning he's going to go teach at Harvard. So we called him up and asked him if we wanted to chat on the way out. Arthur Brooks, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Kai. Great to be with you, as always.
All right, so let's talk about, we've had you on a couple of three, four times in the last 5 or 6 years, talking about a bunch of stuff, right? Poverty, charity, opportunity and dignity through work and all of that. I want to talk, though, for a second about the state of public discourse today. And I'm going to go to AEI's motto. Literally, its motto. It says, a competition of ideas is fundamental to a free society, a competition of ideas. How are we doing here in 2018 with that competition?
It's not great. It's not great. I wish it were better. I mean, AEI exists because it's always a challenge to have a competition of ideas. Disagreement is in bad shape. Ideas are the engine of what makes an innovative economy change. We don't have that. We're destined for mediocrity.
Well, we don't have that right now, Arthur. I mean, come on, man.
Well, I mean, we do in a lot of places. In business, we certainly have that. The business climate in many parts of the American economy are more vital and better than they've ever been. Where we have it too little is right now in a moment of political populism. And why is that? Because it becomes very insular. It becomes tribal. When you get those things, you're going to have just less ferment.
Hmm. Let me take a detour with this next question. I was in Minnesota the other day talking to Neil Kashkar, the president of the Minneapolis Fed and also the guy who ran, as you know, TARP for Hank Paulson at Treasury during the financial crisis. Very smart guy. And we're going to air that interview, I guess, on Tuesday. But I asked him what he thought the legacy of the financial crisis was. And he said, basically, the political division we have today, some of the unrest that we have today comes straight out of that. And you've talked about this, and I wonder what you think about what Kashkar said.
I think it's right. The knock-on effect of a financial crisis is really uneven economic growth. So we can always talk about the economic growth rate is 2.9 or 3.2 or 4.1% or whatever we're measuring right now. But the problem is in the decade after financial crises is that almost all that economic growth is concentrated in the top fifth of the income distribution. Now, the political result of having stagnation in the bottom 80% is political populism, is despair across parts of the economy that people who are just looking at net aggregates, they don't see. The policy solution to this, to the extent that there is one, is for all of us to work for more even economic growth, pushing opportunity out to the periphery of society. This is an opportunity for economic conservatives and people who talk more about social justice for people at the margins of society to work together because we have a common goal here.
Well, so this gets to some of your ideas that we've talked about the last number of years on this program, right? The moral case for free enterprise, the dignity that comes with opportunity to work and to do things. Do you think you've gotten traction on that in the past 10 years, or have you been shouting into the hurricane?
Well, you know, when you're in the world of ideas, it's very easy to feel like you're shouting into a hurricane. Why? Because you're kind of a climate scientist in a world that's more interested in weather reports. Politics is like the weather. Ideas are climate science. But in the end, in the long run, it's ideas that matter the most.
Are you an optimist then?
You know, Kai, I think I'm hopeful. An optimist is somebody who says, it's going to be okay. Somebody who's hopeful says, something can be done that's good, and we can affect it. It's really in our hands. I mean, you and I, we're in these great positions to try to talk to big audiences, to help people understand things differently. And a lot of people who are listening to us are in leadership positions as well. I'm extremely hopeful that we're at the beginning of what I think is a new time in American politics, in a new time in the American life of ideas. That's the kind of aspirational hope that I have. And I actually think that we're at the beginning of a big majority of people seeing that that's possible and maybe bringing it about.
Arthur Brooks, for another 6 or 8 or 10 months, the president of the American Enterprise Institute, and then, as announced today, a professor at Harvard. Arthur, thanks a lot for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Kai. I appreciate it a lot.
If you've ever lived in a city or in a neighborhood that's full of bars and restaurants, you know it gets pretty loud, right? Great for the nightlife that brings tourists and revenues that cities need and count on. Not very great, though, for the local residents. Examples of which can be found around the country. Bourbon Street in New Orleans, Georgetown in Washington, D.C., and increasingly, as Ryan Kyloth reports, the Lower East Side of Manhattan.
The Lower East is actually a bunch of different neighborhoods. There's the Puerto Rican Lower East Side, the Chinese section, and then there's this slice of the neighborhood that locals like to call
Hell's Square. It's like basic times drunk, times like we're just going to get emotional.
Julia Rose, admittedly, has had a few drinks herself. Hell's Square is just three square blocks, but it has more than 70 businesses selling alcohol. Around 50 have a full liquor license.
People get very dumb. We witnessed a fight that happened over the course of multiple blocks. We tracked it.
Hot pink Hummer limousines, bachelorettes with giant balloons, Jägermeister vomit.
Just a few of Jeremiah Moss's favorite things. He's lived in the area for over 20 years. Moss barricades himself in his apartment weekends, but what he can't escape is the noise.
The sound has these different layers. If you walk down 2nd Avenue on a weekend night, there's this oceanic roar. And then this is punctuated by screaming girls. And then you have guys who will get into a scrum and chant, like whoop, 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 kind of whooping themselves up.
It's not hard to find locals who share Moss's disdain. At the Neighborhood Community Board, that's the most local form of government here, you can't turn around without knocking over a stack of complaints.
These are liquor license folders for me to go through.
District Manager Susan Stetzer has an entire room of file cabinets, taller than she is, devoted to liquor-licensed businesses and the complaints they attract.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 12, 15, 16, 17 drawers of active licenses. You look at this. Some of them have very, very, very large folders.
Since 2000, the number of liquor licenses in Hell's Square zip code has more than quadrupled. There's a state law that's supposed to prevent this kind of saturation. It says,
if there's three or more within 500 feet, you have to show public interest. However, the state liquor authority considers public interest like we have fine Italian food.
The liquor authority didn't grant an interview, but New York has an obvious incentive to encourage nightlife. Ariel Palitz says the industry supports over 300,000 jobs and generates revenue in the tens of billions. She's head of the mayor's new office on nightlife, and she's extremely on message.
Do you happen to know the nickname for that little slice of the neighborhood, Houston and Allen, Delancey and Essex?
I do know what people have referred to it in the past, but I've chosen to look at this as more of a social circle rather.
I love that.
Yes.
Recently at a bar in Hell Square, their social circle, King Esubantan was working the door.
I know there's a lot of liquor around here, you know, but people spend money, you know, and there's no gunshots out here. People enjoying the night.
Esubantan says people shouldn't move to an area with a lot of bars if they don't like it. Though, of course, he's getting paid to be here. If he wasn't, he says, he'd be anywhere else right now. In New York, I'm Ryan Kyloff for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, President Trump sent letters to the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate this morning saying he is canceling the 2.1% pay raise and certain location-based increases those federal civilian workers were set to get next year. Quote, "We must maintain efforts to put our nation on a fiscally sustainable course, and federal agency budgets cannot sustain such increases." Two things about that. First of all, according to the Congressional Budget Office, last year's GOP tax bill will add $1.5 trillion to the national debt over 10 years. Also, and this is according to the Office of Personnel Management, those workers, government workers, they are spread all over. 132,000 in Texas, 152,000 here in California, 60,000 in New York, 42,000 in North Carolina. They are all over the country. All right, we got to go. With the possibility of more tariffs on the horizon, the Dow off 137 today, about 0.5%. NASDAQ down 21, that's 0.25%. S&P 500 slumped 12 points, about 0.25% there as well. John Buckley, Eve Epstein, Stephen Gregory, John Gordon, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Debke. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.